teach the kids, when I teach the kids, because the feedback is so instantaneous. If they don't like what you're saying, you know it right away. So one of the little surprises I've had in encountering the Buddha's teachings is that some of his teachings are universally applicable. They don't necessarily pertain to Buddhism. And they are teachings and skills about developing or applying ourselves in human endeavors, or any endeavor that we engage in. And sometimes it's helpful to realize that some of his teachings have to do with, are applicable beyond the scope of Buddhist practice. Then maybe it makes it more accessible to us, or maybe understand how it is a Buddhist practice, or why we might want to do it. And the teaching I want to talk about today is called the Four Right Efforts. The Four Efforts. And it's something that has come slow to me to appreciate these, partly because of the background I had in my early Buddhist practice in Zen, I think, the way I understood it, Zen practice, that I was disinclined to want to talk about or teach it, this thing about effort. It's very strange, because I like making effort, but I couldn't quite relate to the classic teachings on it, so much so that this is very embarrassing, of course, for a Buddhist teacher to say. But that about 7-8 years ago, I did a series of Monday night talks on the Eightfold Path, and I just skipped the one on right effort. In some ways, hopefully, it was a good thing to skip, since I couldn't quite relate to it in the way back then so well that I hadn't made it my own. But now, since that time, I've understood that this is something I do all the time, have always done. All human beings do this. And now, understanding how universal it is, I begin to really appreciate it as part of Buddhist practice, and something I've also done as Buddhist practice, and still do. So, to be very simple about the four efforts, the four right efforts, I'll give you four words that characterize them. Even back in the Buddhist time, they characterized them by four words, and then they elaborated on it. And the four words, the way I translate it into English, is the first is to prevent, the second is to abandon, the third is to cultivate, and the fourth is to keep. So prevent, abandon, cultivate, and keep. And that makes the acronym PAC. And when you walk, when you go on a long path, you bring your backpack with you. Pack something along. And these are the four things you need to pack along with you. These four efforts. And so my background a little bit, as I kind of engaged in Zen practice in my early years, is, it's a little bit simplistic, but the way I understood Zen practice was, it was a practice of unconditionally accepting the present moment as it is. And it was not about a goal, or getting something, or accomplishing anything. It wasn't about preventing anything. It wasn't about cultivating anything. It wasn't about abandoning anything. And it wasn't about keeping anything. So none of these four efforts, I understood, was part of the Zen practice. It was the practice simply, here we are, and let's completely, fully be present and accept this moment as it is. Not before it or against it, but be very, very present. And anything else seemed extra. It seemed like you're adding something onto reality. If you're going to try to prevent something, that's you're denying something. If you're trying to cultivate and develop something, that is, in some sense, you're not happy with how things are. And the practice is to learn how to be fully here for how things actually are. And in classic Zen training, it's a very rigorous training to do those things. It's not like you sit around your couch, accept things as they are. But it's quite a rigorous training, but still, training, So, but I wondered about, my anger, for example. should I just, you know, that's all I could do, was just accept it, you know, just be there with it, be present for it, and that's it. So while I was at the Zen monastery for a period of time, I worked in the garden, and I loved the garden, loved working in the garden. And so I had a lot of reflections and thoughts about what it was like to be a gardener and work in the garden. And it seemed like seemed that in the garden, it was pretty natural to try to prevent weeds from growing. It was pretty natural to pull weeds that had grown, pull them out and throw them away. And it was pretty normal in the garden, as a gardener, to try to cultivate things. That's one of my job descriptions was cultivate the garden, grow the plants. And then, and once they had grown, to keep them, to maintain them, to sustain them. And I thought, well, if this is normal in a garden, why not? Why treat my mind any different way? Why is my mind a different category of things than the garden? It's part of the natural world to have a garden, in a sense. Why should it be unnatural to engage in weeding my mind? And I felt, well, there is nothing unnatural about weeding my mind, but it's the attitude I have while I do it that maybe is important. And so if the attitude is one of somehow characterized by greed or ambition or characterized by aversion or hate, then maybe it's not such a useful thing to do. But if it just kind of seemed more like brushing your teeth, when we brush our teeth, we prevent, right? Prevent tooth decay. We abandon, we get rid of those little guys in there. And then we, you know, I guess, I don't know if we cultivate our teeth. We try to keep them as long as we can. So I had a sense that in this practice of accepting things as they are, there was also a place, that a natural place, part of the momentum and movement of the mind, was to engage in an appropriate way with some of the inner stuff of the mind. And so if I had anger, I didn't have to be for or against the anger, I could just be present for it fully. But in being present for it, I could also work with it. I could try to pull that weed out, and or try to prevent it from arising. So the idea of preventing, abandoning, cultivating, and keeping is something that applies in any human endeavor, probably, that we want to do. Brushing our teeth, doing a garden, cooking, you know, and just, you know, whatever we do, those somehow come into play. We have something in mind, we have a purpose, we have an endeavor, we have some direction we want to go, and so we try to prevent from happening those things that interfere with that. We try to abandon the interfering things that have arisen. We try to cultivate the things that would make that possible, what we're trying to do. And once we're cultivating those things, we try to sustain it long enough so we can succeed in our efforts. Some of you probably do it in your driving. You listen to the traffic report, and you prevent going down 101 when there's traffic, and you go 280. You prevent your, you know, you have a purpose to get somewhere. You prevent or avoid things that get in the way of that. If you find yourself on 280 and it's a bumper to bumper, you abandon 280. If you're Al Camino or something. And or if you have enough sense, you know, you kind of cultivate the better way to drive. So in some way or other, you can understand these four things as something we apply in all our activities. My favorite little teaching around this that I heard outside of Buddhism was someone heard these four right efforts in Buddhism and said, "Oh, I'm a kayaker." And this is what we're taught to do in kayaking. We're taught, avoid getting into trouble. If you get into trouble, get out of trouble. Cultivate good habits, good skills in kayaking, good habits for kayaking. And then, having cultivated them, keep practicing them, keep maintaining them. That's, you know, that's pretty good. So if you're in trouble, you know, First of all, don't get yourself in trouble to begin with. If you're in trouble, then figure out how to get out. And then, cultivate the opposite. So in Buddhism, these four efforts sometimes are called the four right efforts. And it's the sixth of the Eightfold Path. And the word right is very important here. Even though some people react to the word right because of right and wrong, and who's to say what's right and wrong, and if the Buddhists are right, then it must mean that someone else is wrong, and what's with this right word? But anyways, the word is samma, and we usually translate it into English as right. But what I think the implications here is that it right not in the sense of some big judgment of what other people do, but it's what's right for the task. So if you want to, if you want to cook a big pot of soup, you need the right pot, So you need the right knife to cut the vegetables. You need the right thing. You need the right time. We use that word in English a lot. We need the right thing. The fact that it's the wrong pot, the fact that your neighbor has the wrong pot, it just means you don't borrow it. It doesn't mean that the neighbor is bad or wrong. But if you want to make soup, you need the right pot. So there has to be some sense of what you're doing. And the Eightfold Path, classically, it's all a description of what are the tools, what are the things needed to accomplish a particular thing. So then you have to ask yourself, what is that particular thing that you're trying to accomplish, that the Eightfold Path is trying to accomplish? And it's trying to accomplish peace. It's trying to accomplish freedom. It's trying to accomplish the cultivation of liberation. And this is a huge endeavor for Buddhists. Some people pursue a little bit of liberation, just a little bit of peace. Some people pursue a medium amount. And some people want to try to touch into it as much as they possibly can in this lifetime, or go all the way as far as they can. And so depending on the motivation the person has, depending how far a person wants to go with this task of peace or liberation or freedom, has a lot to do with how much effort they'll put into trying to attain that. If you're just, there are people who are called nightstand Buddhists. And that's all, it's fine to be a nightstand Buddhist. It means that, you buy the books and you have them on your nightstand and that's what you do as you're falling asleep. And apparently that's, there's a whole category in the book publishing business about nightstand Buddhists. There's no real commitment or investment in the practice itself. It's reading inspirational things and, that's great. I should do that. It's great. I should do this. I'm so happy to be a Buddhist. It's great. It's really good stuff. It's like endlessly reading the menu. Sooner or later the waitress or the waiter is going to be impatient with you, How many times are you going to read that menu? We're closing soon. You're going to die soon. pretty soon you got to put it into practice. So then, depending on how serious you are about what you want to do, depends how seriously you apply and engage in these four right efforts. And now the classic wording of the four right efforts is something like, when applies oneself to prevent the arising of unarisen, unskillful states of mind. That's kind of a mouthful, right? So we're preventing the arising of something which hasn't arisen yet. So you prevent, and what you're trying to prevent is the arising of what in Buddhism is called unskillful states of mind, unskillful qualities of mind. This word unskillful and skillful are very important technical terms in Buddhism. Sometimes they're translated into English as wholesome and unwholesome. But if you're trying to accomplish something, almost anything, you need certain kind of skill. So if you're cooking soup, you need to have some skill in cooking a soup. And so you need to cultivate that skill, you develop that skill. If you have, if you don't have skill, if you're, you can't really make a soup. Or if you do unskillful things. So like one of the unskillful things to do when you're making soup is to turn on the soup and, and then leave the house for 4 hours. And you come back and it's, just burnt, just kind of black and barbecued soup. That's an unskillful thing to do if you want to make soup. So almost any endeavor at all, there are skillful and unskillful things to do. So in Buddhism also, there are things that are skillful and unskillful, things that are helpful for following that path to freedom, and things which are not helpful. So the things which are not helpful, things which are unskillful, if you want to do this path, you prevent those unskillful things from arising. And the unskillful things that we're trying to prevent arising primarily are mental states, mental qualities, mental reactions, mental things that arise. So there are certain mental qualities inside yourself which are considered not helpful for engaging in the path. So, for example, being really agitated is unskillful, it's not very helpful if you want to follow this path. For example, the path often involves meditation practice. And if you're really agitated, as probably some of you know very well, it's very hard to meditate. So if meditation is an important part of your path, you want to try to avoid agitation. And in general, agitation, not just in meditation, but in normal life, interferes with helping us see clearly what is really going on. And seeing clearly is one of the primary things we need in order to become free. So we try to prevent becoming agitated. How do we do that in a skillful way, in a helpful way, is a very interesting question. How do we avoid being agitated? So each of you has your own way. And what this requires then is self-study. It requires studying yourself, understanding yourself, being mindful of yourself, to know what is it that you do that causes you to be agitated. What do you contribute? What are the situations that cause you to be agitated? And no one else can tell that to you. I think really something you have to kind of look at yourself. You have to begin understanding the causal connections, the causality between cause and effect in your life. That's a required aspect of Buddhist practice, essential. And you have to see, oh, if I do X, then Y happens. So the preventing unskillful states from arising that haven't risen yet. The classic description of this is, there's many, many, many ways of talking about this, but one of the classics is talking about the five hindrances. So preventing the five hindrances from arising, because the five hindrances are the five things which hinder your ability to see clearly. These is desire, certain kinds of desire, caught in the web of desire, aversion, sloth and torpor, agitation, restlessness, and doubt. So desire. So we have to learn how to prevent the arising of certain kinds of desire so they don't get in the way and hinder us. So the classic word that I'm translating as prevent is samvara, which actually means restraint. And this points to a very important aspect of this preventing, learning to restrain. You're going down 101 and there's a beautiful billboard. And they have the latest electronic paperclip. High-tech paperclip. That's like, And it's just, they show this, this gorgeous person, holding the paper, this electronic paperclip. And it's like, so you see that every day you're driving the freeway and you see that paperclip advertisement, and you think, you notice after a while that you spend the next 10 minutes fantasizing about paperclips and buying it and going getting it and being upset because you're on the freeway, you can't get it, and because your boss at work won't let you buy the electronic paperclip, he thinks it's just fine to have the old-fashioned kind. They're so old-fashioned at work, and you're upset and angry, and don't they realize that the image of the whole company is at stake? You're just like these gorgeous people on the ad. And And you notice that you keep doing that as you go down the freeway. You know, day after day, get caught by that paperclip ad. So you realize after a while, this is not helpful for me. This is not skillful. So next time you go down, you maybe you avert your eyes even maybe from that bulletin board. Or you look at it, and this is an important part of restraint. Is you look, you might see it, and then you don't allow your mind to embellish on what you've seen. Just, oh, there's a bulletin board, there's a billboard. There's a billboard. I see it, I see the paperclip, it's nice. Let's keep focusing on the driving here. And so you restrain the mind. You use the veto power that the mind has to say, I'm not going there. Thank you. Because I know if I go there, I'm going to end up being agitated. So I don't need to pick those thoughts up and get involved. Using the veto power that you have is a really important part of this preventing unskillful states from arising. The story about the veto power is the image that the human mind is like a corporate boardroom where everybody has a right to speak up. However, in that corporate boardroom, the chairperson has the veto power. So you're the chair of your corporate boardroom. And so you can't prevent certain things to arise in your mind. All kinds of things will arise. Desires, aversions, all kinds of things will arise. But you have some choice about what the corporation picks up and goes along with. And so we can exercise that veto power. Oh, I don't think I'm going to do that. Thank you. So this, you know, example of the billboard with the paperclip is, you know, can be applied in all kinds of different areas. If, you know, if you have a problem with food, then how do you relate to food and food issues? You know, maybe you should not, you know, maybe you need to prevent certain kind of activity in relationship to food so you don't get caught by that addiction. Or alcohol, or with sex, or with, you know, money, or with, you know, all kinds of things. Maybe you need to be careful about the input you get, the stimulus you get. Sometimes it's appropriate to avoid it entirely. And sometimes it involves, and this is the Buddhist practice, is to restrain yourself or exercise that veto power when you're in the presence of it. And classically in Buddhism, this is called guarding the sense doors. Safeguarding yourself with the sense doors, which is using that veto power and saying, oh, I see it, but we're not going to get on that train of thought and embellish it and off we go and something happens. So there's all kinds of directions your mind can take. You can get, you know, it can be desire thoughts, it can be anger thoughts, ill will thoughts, judgmental thoughts, all kinds of directions you can go, which you have to learn are not skillful. So it requires studying yourself, understanding yourself, understanding what the qualities of mind are that you have, which seem to interfere or worse than interfere, take you in the different direction than the direction you want to go. And if what you do want to do is to go in the direction of peace, liberation, and freedom, then it's essential to learn how not to let your thinking or your mind be in charge. Then you're not free. You have to learn how to say, okay, no, thank you. I'm not going to go that way. I'm not going to use that. I'm not going to pick that up. And it's really helpful then to begin organizing your life in such a way that the unskillful tendencies you have are less likely to arise. So we do that on retreat. If you go on retreat, a meditation retreat, carefully controlled environment. We can't control it entirely, but it's an environment where we have carefully controlled it so that it was really hard, maybe. But we really controlled it so we have no television sets, either in the meditation hall or in the lobby outside the meditation hall. You know, many lobbies, they have television sets. You know, you go to Kaiser, it's up there, and, you know, it's blasting away, and you can't turn it off. And it's part of our society, right? And It's hard for some people, but we've decided in meditation halls we're going to prevent that from happening because we've learned that if we have we haven't learned because we have never done it. I'm kind of joking here, but but it's our supposition from our experiences at home that if we had a television set on at the retreat center, that it just doesn't create the right kind of mindset, the mind conditions, to really be able to go settle deep and get concentrated and really get present for oneself. I remember many years ago, I used to watch football. 10 years ago or so, I used to watch some football when the 49ers were doing well. Fair weather friend that I am. And I kind of enjoyed watching it. But the amazing thing to me was at the end of the game, watching on television, I felt terrible. I felt kind of drained and headachy, and I don't know if it happens to other people that way, but somehow that sitting there watching that kind of tube thing and the light, and I just didn't feel good, compared to the good state I had before. So retreat culture is a culture where we intentionally kind of prevent certain things. We don't have newspapers. We don't read. We have almost no conversations on retreats, because conversations tend to be more agitating. Normal conversations are healthy, it's fine, but on retreat we're trying to develop a very, very deep state of tranquility, of stillness in the mind, and conversations actually bump us up to a more coarse level of the mind, and we want to keep the mind this very refined level, so we keep the conversations very, very, very much to the minimum. So sometimes it's very healthy in life, I believe, to look at your life, your behavior, your activities, the things you do, the input, the stimulus that comes in, and make a decision. How can I change the stimulus, the activities, so that I'm less likely to be stimulated, or I'm less likely to stimulate unhelpful states of mind? I don't think that's necessarily aversion to do that. Aversion is an unskillful state of mind. And they have to. And part of this practice then is to avoid the arising of unskillful states of mind, even unskillful minds in relationship to unskillful states of mind. Isn't that great? I think that's just the best. So you can't, you can't have aversion to your aversion, because that's unskillful. So you have to have a skillful attitude to your aversion, which means that you have to see that it's not wise to have it, and let's see what we can do here. Without aversion, let's see what we can do to prevent it. So sometimes it involves behavioral change. And sometimes it involves developing the mindfulness and the presence of mind, so that when things come your way, that you use your vitto power. You don't pick it up. You don't engage in it. You don't embellish in it. You don't let your mind wander off and think forever about it. And the mindfulness practice is very helpful for that. The mindfulness practice where you really see this is what's happening, and really see it, really acknowledge it. This is what's happening. One of the things I strongly recommend often in mindfulness is noting, the practice of mental noting. And one area that's extremely useful to do mental noting is around thinking. Because what I've noticed, at least, is that I could be mindful and kind of know I'm thinking, kind of know I'm letting go of my thoughts, going back to the breath. And, it's kind of going fine. But actually, I'm a little bit fooling myself. I kind of think I'm letting go of my thoughts. I kind of think I'm not kind of engaged so much in thinking, but I'm kind of drifting a lot in my thoughts. But if I stop to really name the fact I'm thinking, really have an acknowledgement that comes with mentally saying, oh, I'm thinking, then that the acknowledgement is much more complete and full. And with that fuller acknowledgement, something different happens in the ecology of the mind. Then if I just kind of know that I'm thinking, kind of let go of it, the full acknowledgement, the full seeing of it and recognizing it helps create a certain kind of overview, distance, independence, freedom from it that's different than if I don't actually say, oh, I am thinking. This is what's happening. So to fully, completely and label, oh, this is what's happening, is very, very helpful in this practice of using your vitto power. So, oh, this is what's happening. Oh, I'm about to go off. I feel the impulse of starting to go off, thinking about this kind of thing, obsessing about this. Yes, I'm starting to obsess. This is what it's like for a human being to obsess. You really kind of get into admitting it and saying it. This is what's going on. Thank you. you know, kind of like, well, yeah, you know, I'll kind of in corner of my mind kind of admit, you know, I'm obsessing a little bit. You know, it doesn't have any commitment to it or presence or power to it. But if you really stop and say, yes, this is what I'm doing. So, prevent. So to prevent the arising of unarisen, unskillful states of mind. I think it's great. I've come around. And it's something I think it's something we all do all the time. I don't think this is foreign to us. But what the Buddha said is you have to understand this. It's helpful to understand this. This is a part of what we do also in Buddhist practice. And we do it for a certain purpose. And if you don't understand your purpose, then it's a lot easier to have clarity about what is, you know, what your choices are in this regard. So that's preventing. And that's as far as I'm going to go today. Preventing is great. And maybe if things go along as they could go, then and next week I'll maybe talk about abandoning, and the second of the four right efforts. And abandoning is a powerful word. You know, what are these Buddhists doing about abandoning stuff? And there's some, you know, but abandoning is one of these whole big family of words that exists in Buddhism that are related to letting go. And people sometimes ask, how do you let go? How do you let go? And so that's what the topic is next week. Letting go, abandoning, as the second of the four right efforts. So we have actually some time, and I intentionally stopped early, so you could have comments or questions or reservations or whatever you'd like to do in the 5 minutes we have left. If you could use the mic, then everyone can hear. There are people who can't hear otherwise.
It's simple to avert your eyes on 101 from the electronic paper clip.
You're not tempted by that?
In comparison to people,
yes,
who agitate you, can you comment a little bit further on prevention in that regard of agitation?
Well, you know, I mean, you're asking in such a broad way. You probably have something more specific in mind. But so, for example, if you go into a supermarket and you notice that you're judging everybody's purchase, you know everybody buys, you're there judging, how could they buy that? They shouldn't buy that. And they're making too much of that and too little of that. And what's going on with those people? And don't they know any better? And you realize when you leave the supermarket, you're just exhausted. But you need to buy food. So, you know, that's a skillful thing to do. So you could, you know, order it online and the market will deliver it, so you don't have to go. You could go and say, okay, this is not helpful for me. I've realized that the cost that it has of me to do all this judging. I think what I'll do is I'm just going to keep my list in front of me. I'm going to keep my eyes down in my shopping cart. I'll go to the aisle, I'll look at the thing. I'll just not look at people. I won't look and see what they're buying. And then you do that and you realize you leave the store quite peaceful because the judgment hasn't come in. You're not agitated. So sometimes just avoiding, if you can, like with strangers and people, you know, that can be helpful. And the bigger picture is probably spiritually much more healthy, it's sooner or later, is to actually look and see what is it's going on for you if judgment is the issue. What's really going on there? So then you might actually go into the store and say, okay, today I'm going to look at everybody. In fact, I'm going to linger in there for a long time. And I'm going to make a study of what happens in my mind when I see someone. What's really going on there? What's the different steps? What's my feelings, my emotions, my impulses, the beliefs that come into play? So I really need to get to the bottom of this. So that's another approach, to get to the bottom of it, really see what's going on. And getting to the bottom of it, this thing's very helpful, because if you start understanding what are the triggers inside of us, why is it some people are agitating for us? And some of the times, sometimes you'll find out that people are never agitating to you. You agitate yourself by how you pick up or relate or react to what they are doing. And at least that's kind of the theory that's useful, or the assumption that's useful to carry when you're practicing. The assumption, you carry the assumption that the problem is not out there with my agitation. No one's agitating me. Something about what I'm doing is agitating me. What is it I'm doing? How am I relating? And so you want to get to the bottom of that, you know? And then that's one of the things you can do. Another thing you can do is the last two of the right efforts, and that is you can cultivate skillful states of mind. So before you can cultivate a strong capacity for equanimity, a strong capacity for mindfulness, cultivate a strong capacity for calm, tranquility, strong capacity for joy, and cultivate strong mental qualities, so that it's kind of like a ballast then. So you go into situations where people are agitating, it's not going to push you over, it's not going to agitate you. So you know that you have this, you have to go talk to someone who's always upsets you. So before you go, you know the condition, you know the cause and effect, you know that if you don't eat, you don't sleep, you don't exercise, before you have to talk to that person, you're, in trouble. So make sure you can, have a balanced life beforehand, meditate, eat well, get a good night's sleep, maybe go for a little walk before you actually go into the person's office, and then you might find yourself much more able to manage.
Could you talk a little more about the five hindrances?
The five hindrances. I could.
I know that's a big question. Just briefly, because I've never heard of them before.
Oh, you haven't heard of them before? Okay. The five hindrances, the Buddhist word is nivarana. It literally means the coverings, the obscurations, the things that obscure or cover or hinder a certain thing that we want to do. And the primary one for us is two things, clear seeing, to be able to see clearly, and then to be able to have a calm and concentrated mind. And there's many things that interfere with clear seeing and calm and concentrated mind. For some reason, the Buddha selected these five as being the most important. And I think because when mind starts getting concentrated in meditation, these are the ones that are kind of the last barrier to really make it difficult to go into a whole different level of concentration. So they become particularly important for meditators. And the first two have to do with our relationship to the things. We either want or we want to push them away. We either have desire or we have aversion. And there's a whole slew of subcategories of desire or aversion that come into play. But often human beings get caught by that, by desire and aversion, and get pulled into their orbit. And so they can't really see clearly, or they get agitated. And then the next two are also paired, in a sense. The next one is sloth and torpor. It's actually two for the number three. Sloth and torpor. And I like to think of that as resistance. It's not just tiredness. It's kind of like resistance, or being depressed, or being discouraged, or being, it's a lack of enthusiasm. Kind of just feel kind of pulled down. And then the opposite of that is being restless or agitated. We also might have resistance, or we might kind of be confused or upset or challenged by what's going on. And we're challenged by what's going on instead of being kind of just, oh, I give up. It's more like we run around like trapped rats, get agitated. And then the last one is doubt. And it's said that doubt is the most dangerous one in Buddhism, because doubt will cause you to give up the practice. And doubt yourself, I can't do this, or doubt what you're doing. This is not the right thing or the right time. These are not the right people to do it with. This is not, you know, just doubt, 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 uncertainty. So these are very powerful forces, and anybody who's going to do mindfulness meditation needs to be become really skilled. Remember the word skilled? Really skilled at identifying these and working with them. And you only become really skilled by them, skilled in identifying them and working with them, if you stop and let them in and really, you know, don't push them away too quickly. But really get to do it. Your task is when they arise to really get to know them and understand them well. And so this Buddhist spirituality puts a lot of emphasis not on abandoning or letting go too quickly, but rather let go when you really understand something well. And I had a newsletter article a couple of newsletters ago on the five hindrances, so you can get a little summary there. Okay, so so during this next week, you might experiment, play around with preventing the arising of non-arisen, unskillful states. Stay out of trouble. Thank you.